This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
Well, the latest news from the financially troubled retailer Sears, which is, by the way, in Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization right now, is to have to close 26 more stores around the country, Sears and Kmart stores. And unfortunately, it's come close to home. It's, in fact, it's finally hit Northwest Indiana with the news that the Sears store in South Lake Mall is one of those that is slated to be closed yet this year. What's the concern? Well, of course, there is major concern financially, but there is some hope. At least if many people are thinking that. And one of those is Hobart Mayor Brian Snediger, and he's with us to talk about it. Mr. Mayor, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, glad to join you.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you found out about the news from Sears that they were going to have to put the mall store in Hobart on the next list.
Well, of course, as the news media announcements broke, certainly I had a follow-up conversation with the mall management, and we discussed, kind of the timetable and the impact certainly it could make. As you know, Sears, the actual Sears store, is a standalone property owned by Sears, not the mall themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So even the mall is kind of in a wait and see what Sears plans to do with that property. If you look at some of the current properties where there was a Sears store and had closed, you see where they've redeveloped the property, whether it's turning into eateries and other lifestyles for people to gather. So we're optimistic that something good will come out of this. And I think, the mall management has been very progressive in trying to stay ahead of, some of the, pitfalls of the retail market in today's world dealing with the e-commerce. And I think the management at the mall will do a very good job of working with Sears representatives to restructure that property as need be to make it, not a detriment, but an improvement to the mall as a whole. So I'm excited about what the future can hold.
Do you get the impression in talking with the folks that own South Lake Mall that maybe when the Carson's store in the mall closed or was about to close, that kind of got them to wake up or be aware that there may be something ahead for Sears? And obviously we're keeping an eye on the latest business news about the overall state of affairs for Sears to begin with.
Yes, I think it was fair to in our conversations, certainly before the announcement, we knew that this was an issue that potentially could occur. And, the Mishawaka Sears, I believe, also was announced as closing. So it's not just this region. As you mentioned, it's across the country.
Yeah.
And, I will tell you that, the Carson's property is also a standalone. That's not owned by the mall. We have been in conversations with the mall and the owners of the Carson's building about repurposing that property in something that would be a real positive for the mall itself. And I think there's some real potential there. We're not at a point yet where there can be, anything that's, locked and done. But I do believe there's a willingness to work cooperatively as a city and the mall and the owners of the Carson's building to try to make something really good come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, we think that the mall, if there was going to be a location for a convention center in Northwest Indiana, we think that the mall could be an ideal location. You already have hospitality adjacent to the mall. You have eateries that are inside the mall and outside the mall. We do believe that would be the best location in Northwest Indiana. And the mall has been a staple for Northwest Indiana. And I think that's a partnership that we want to continue to build upon.
And I know the city of Hobart's had a presence and continues to have a presence. Of course, they're in the mall and not very far from Sears. They've got the police station that's located there, which helps, I'm sure, the mall security folks, and they're keeping an eye on things. You have several events that happen there on a regular basis in the mall or nearby. Do you obviously are concerned about what would be the loss of tax money if something should happen to the and in the closing of the Sears store. But I suppose that this situation, because Sears owns the facility and not the mall operators, that might at least bring some hope for the city of Hobart that the tax dollars, even though they may be reduced, would still be there?
Oh, you're exactly right. I think that, you know, we're looking progressively as a city. As you know, we're in the process right now of creating a TIF district for the Route 30 corridor that would encompass potentially all the way to 69th Avenue. So we're thinking in a positive way that through, you know, contemporary growth ideas and dealing with lifestyles, we can repattern some of the Route 30 area to actually make this a positive. You know, everybody, I keep reminding everybody that, yes, e-commerce, you know, shopping online with the Amazons and Walmarts and so forth, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but you can't forget the brick-and-mortar stores that make your community. And so, you know, I always try to stress to people, don't forget, those are the people who are paying taxes in your community, and we never should forget the importance of supporting them, no matter how sometimes, you know, people may not want to leave their house and they'd rather sit at home on a computer and shop. They can't forget that without those vital brick-and-mortar stores, your community is not going to be the community it can be, because you rely on those tax dollars, and you know, that helps with residential tax structures. So we have to understand how important that is.
We'll get back to the question about housing in just a moment here. We're talking with Hobart Mayor Brian Snedeker. One last point I'd like to ask about the Sears situation. Do the folks at Starwood Retail Partners, the owners of the mall, keep you up to date on what they happen to hear directly from Sears about things like liquidation sales and more of a timetable for closing and things?
Yes, there is communication as the mall is informed of what Sears' intentions are. Certainly the mall has kept in contact with us. The general manager of the mall has been good to share with us. Certainly, like you said, our police has a definite presence there, both on-duty and off-duty officers. So we want to definitely stay in the loop of what the short and long-term plans are.
Now, getting to the question about housing, it's been brought up lately about the fact that the city of Hobart obviously would like to bring more residents in for all the benefits that they can get from being in the city of Hobart, and the city itself drawing from having all the residents there. That, of course, means more houses, more housing of some type in the area. And I understand that, that there are several projects that are sort of in the works that the city of Hobart's trying to address the question about having enough housing in the area. Tell us what the latest is.
Yeah, Chris, the timing on this interview really is unique. Yesterday, we did the groundbreaking for the Eagle Creek development, and that's going to be 48 homes being built on a parcel of land off of 61st in Arizona. Very exciting opportunity here. You know, when Wainwright made the decision to come to Hobart, that was a huge win for Northwest Indiana. They came here from up by O'Hare Airport. And as you know, it's going to create about 500 jobs when Wainwright opens their doors. There's going to be a huge impact to the workforce. And as you know, there's been other developments go into the North Winds Crossings light industrial area. And so we understand with the hospital doing their $40 million expansion, there's a lot of jobs that have been created in the city. But what we have identified as a deficiency is that we need more housing stock, and we need some higher-end housing stock to keep up with the demands of our city. And so with Eagle Creek, we also have Crestmore Golf Course, the former Crestmore Golf Course. That is being undertaken as we speak also with Luxor Builders, and there will be other builders that will be coming in. That's going to be, when it's all said and done, about a 400 housing development. And then also the city is taking appraisals on a large tract of land, about 60 acres of city land on 61st Avenue that the city owns, that we're going to consider doing some type of development that would include residential. So there's a lot of exciting opportunities going on with residential in the city, but that's one of the areas that we feel that we're a little behind on, and we need to keep up with the continuing growth of the workforce.
Do you have the opportunity sometimes, and of course now with all these projects underway, to get with the developers in the region, and if they are knowing of some properties that might be available out there that they're going to be able to take advantage of and turn into more subdivisions, do they keep you apprised all the time about these things?
Yes, they do, and actually we do too. You know, if we identify properties, you know, a lot of times the city, the Economic Development Department, will get a call from a landowner saying, hey, I'm at a point where I'm ready to sell my land. You know, maybe it's somebody that's retiring. Maybe it's even a farmer that is, you know, getting close to retirement and he's ready to sell off some tracts of land. We will get calls about that, and that helps us because when a developer calls in and says, hey, what are you aware of that's available out there, we can, you know, then make that connection and say, hey, we've been aware of a parcel of land. And that kind of is what happened with the Eagle Creek subdivision. We were aware that Scott Fry was wanting to sell a tract of land that he owned at 61st in Arizona. So we made the connection between the landowner and Cornerstone Developers, which was Eagle Creek. And from there, they came together on some agreements. And the first, you know, next thing you know, here we are getting ready to break ground and build homes. So it's an exciting time.
Now, you mentioned here that groundbreaking's happened for the Eagle Creek Crossing development. What is the status on getting all the permits and everything approved here to get the Crestmore project going?
That is progressing quite well. We're at a development agreement point. There's been appearances by the developer before the plan commission, and there's a large sanitary line that just got installed that runs down Lake Park Avenue and then hooks up with what was the old lift station on Wisconsin Street. That now is allowing growth for that whole area. So everything is moving at fast pace with the Crestmore project currently, and so I look for some ground to be turned there fairly quick also.
That's great. That's great news. Yeah. And the realtors in Northwest Indiana will be happy to hear about all this too. That's one of the things I know in particular, that I have conversations with Pete Novak with the Association of Realtors, that they worry about more new houses out there. There are fewer than ever houses that are available for sale in the region, the houses that are existing, and they're looking forward to new houses being built to help take care of the demand for housing out there in the region. Thank you for the update, and we'll be back, check back with you soon then. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
We're talking with Mayor Brian Snedeker. Purdue University Northwest, the Pride, as the team is called, is now a full member of NCAA Division II. That news came out here late this past month, and we have with us the athletic director of Purdue University Northwest with us, Rick Costello. Rick, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Chris.
This is a process, I understand, that has been going on for several years, as a matter of fact. The big announcement of the actual becoming a full member of Division II may have just come recently, but you've been working on this, seems like a very long process for several years now, I understand.
It's a three-year process to join NCAA Division II. I've actually been the athletic athletic director at Purdue Northwest for 7 years. So I've got to be honest with you, I've been working on it since day one, September of 2012. But so many folks have been involved, students, faculty, staff, the administration, and in the external community, our alumni. It's been an awesome process, which has strengthened Purdue Northwest, the athletics program, and the university.
Since you've been working on this project, since I guess you could literally say before the beginning, since you've been athletics director, what kind of work do you have to do at the outset to get things started so that the process of the provisionary period gets started?
So we went as NAIA members from a very thin rule book to a gargantuan rule book with NCAA Division II. So this process is all about making sure that we admit student athletes as general students, that we process their financial aid, and that we certify their eligibility. It's really, as I mentioned earlier, strengthened the athletics program. It's really brought the faculty and the staff, got them highly involved in what goes on in intercollegiate athletics. It's allowed us to align with some outstanding academic institutions in NCAA Division II. We're members of the Great Lakes Intercollegiate Athletic Conference. Mm-hmm. So we're routinely competing against Grand Valley, Ferris State, University of Wisconsin-Parkside, Michigan Tech University, and schools of that ilk. And then it's also allowed us to recruit just amazing students. We had our highest ever grade point average in the spring at a 3.3 across the board grade point average. So it's allowed us to bring really good people, really great students to Purdue Northwest.
I want to get into the recruiting aspect here in just a moment, but since there's been a three-year provisionary process that you've gone through, at one point, it certainly wasn't probably at year one, but someplace along the way, though, that apparently the NCAA felt that you being the team and the university, felt it was worthy to be able to set up the team so that you could compete with some of the other schools that are out there. What point did you get to that point where did you actually go from just being on paper, having the rules down, showing that we're going to follow the rules, to actually being able to set up the schedule so that you're playing the teams?
Yeah, so for the last 2 years, we've competed in the Great Lakes Athletic Conference, one of the best Division II conferences. Grand Valley routinely wins the Director's Cup, which is the best athletic program in all of Division II. For example, last year we beat them in men's basketball up at Grand Valley. Our softball team took a couple games, our baseball team. So we're really progressing along quite nicely, where we're going to have a very competitive program. This year, our rosters will be 75% student-athletes that have been recruited to Purdue Northwest to compete at the NCAA Division II level. So it's a longer process. The first year is you compete as an NAIA school. The last 2 years, we competed as an NCAA Division II school in the Great Lakes Athletic Conference. And this year, we're now full-fledged and eligible for the NCAA tournament.
We talk about recruiting students, student athletes, I should say, to become members of the teams. What is the process that you at Purdue University Northwest and your staff work on when a student comes in saying that they are interested in taking classes at the Hammond or the Westfield campuses, mm-hmm. or maybe both, depending on what their major plan is going to be, to be able to get involved in being prepared for being a member of a team? What kind of tips or techniques do you get to use to be able to maybe in some cases to persuade? Maybe you don't have to persuade many student athletes to become members of the Pride.
Well, our coaches are very active recruiting. They're out there scouting these student athletes well in advance, so they have an idea of who they would like to be a part of their team. We have fantastic academic programs on campus. Maybe it's engineering, perhaps it's the College of Nursing. Our College of Business is phenomenal. So we have the Purdue Northwest education to attract young people, outstanding academic programs, and then you add wonderful athletic facilities. Dowling Park, which is a partnership with the city of Hammond, is going into its fourth year, which is a state-of-the-art outdoor park for baseball, softball, soccer, and tennis. We just recently, a couple years ago, opened up the Dworkin Center, which is a new $40 million indoor athletic facility for basketball and volleyball on our Westville campus. And we're constantly improving our athletic facilities on the Hammond campus, the Fitness and Recreation Center. So you take that great combination of strong academics, outstanding athletic facilities, all full-time coaches that are just really skilled at their craft. And then the investment in athletic scholarships, and now you have yourself a really good combination to recruit in a very competitive arena.
Now we're about to start another academic year on both the Hammond and the Westfield campuses. Take us through the programs and tell us what the student-athletes are going to be doing. They're probably, if they're not already in training mode, getting ready for the schedules coming up. Tell us what the students are doing now so that they're ready for another year of athletics.
Today's the first full day of practice on campus. Our cross-country students were out bright and early this morning running through the city of Hammond. Both soccer teams are out there practicing, volleyball is practicing, so we're really excited about this fall. I should note that on Saturday, September 7th, is our fall sports festival at Dowling Park from 12 noon to 4 in the afternoon, where baseball, softball, men's and women's soccer, men's and women's tennis will all be competing at the same time right at Dowling Park. So that's really exciting. We will be hosting the GLIAC Cross Country Championships later this semester, October 26th, at our Westville campus. So we'll have 23 cross-country teams representing the GLIAC on campus. So that's roughly 300 athletes. Then you take parents and fans. It's going to be an awesome day out at Westville. You know, on September 23rd, we have our big fundraiser, the Chancellor's Golf Outing out at Sand Creek Country Club. And that'll be a great day for all the folks that are interested in the Pride and our alumni to jump on board and help us raise some scholarship funds, which is our biggest need as we move forward in Division II.
With student athletes, that's just assumed if they're in athletic programs and they're students, they're going to have a little help with their studies, no doubt. What kind of help programs do you have set up within the athletics department for students that maybe are a little bit rough on some of the edges in their courses? They may get themselves up against a bind, but they in turn got to think about not only going to school, go to classes, but they also have to think about the sport that they're in.
Yeah, they have quite a task ahead of them when you compete as a college athlete. We have Jen Magix, our senior women's administrator, our chief academic officer, that handles all the supplemental instruction, the tutoring, to make sure that these kids are advised properly so they can efficiently proceed through Purdue Northwest and attain a degree. But I am so proud. Our kids are students first, athletes second, the highest ever GPA at 3.3. Our women's basketball team, the last 2 years in a row, finished number 2 in the country in team GPA with over a 3.7 average. And what's really cool about that is everybody that sponsors women's basketball. So you take the Dukes of the world, the Harvards, the Vanderbilts, the Stanford. Here we are, Purdue Northwest, right in Northwest Indiana with a higher GPA than those universities. So that's really cool stuff. So we are working really hard in the classroom, but I'm also proud of the Pride because we completed 2,800 hours of community service last year. So got involved with such organizations as Special Olympics, Make-A-Wish Foundation, Alex's Lemonade Stand, and really gave back to the community. I always say, to whom much is given, much is expected in return, and really excited to see the Pride contribute to Northwest Indiana.
Do the students, when they come to campus here in the fall and getting ready for another year, they know they're going to have a busy year, certainly in the classroom. They're going to have a busy year on whatever sports venue they happen to be competing in and practicing to get on. Do they find themselves anxious to get down to work, whether it's in sport or whether it's in the classroom, coming to a campus? Are they very excited about coming to Purdue Northwest, especially if they're freshmen?
The excitement is off the charts. Yesterday we had our athletic orientation, so I got to meet with all the students, and they're just chomping at the bit. Can't wait to put on the black and gold and compete for the Pride.
Well, now that we have the season just about started in whatever sport, or whether it's practice, I guess for some of the sports, of course, later in cold weather months, they'll have sports activities to do as well. Where can people find out if they're not familiar with where the information's there to stay on top of how the teams are doing and the students as well?
PNWathletics.com is our website, and of course we're on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Go on our website. You'll find all kinds of great scheduling information. We have our season pass for $50. You get in any game all season long. I think that's like 10 cents per game. Mm-hmm. So the best deal in town. Our basketball teams are going to be really exciting this year. Men's basketball is led by Boomer Roberts in his second season, and we have a new coach this year for women's basketball, Courtney Locke. So we can't wait to see those Cagers on the court, going up and down and creating some excitement. I think Northwest Indiana is going to be really excited about the Division II athletic program right in their backyard.
Now, Rick, how about your colleagues out there, the fellow ADs that are out there at the universities that you and the teams are going to be competing against? When the news came out about becoming fully involved in Division II, did you get a lot of congratulations? Did you get maybe thanks, and good luck, but not too much luck?
Exactly. They were all very pleased that the GLIAC has another full-fledged member. But the combination of our location, the closest Division II is all the way down in Indianapolis, in the state of Indiana. So we have a lot of fertile recruiting ground here. And a lot of exciting things. We just started a couple new sports, men's volleyball and men's ice hockey. Mm-hmm. Men's ice hockey will play this fall at the Ice Cube, which is right in Hammond at Dowling Park. We have over 20 individuals recruited for that team. So really excited to bring ice hockey to the region, collegiate ice hockey. And it'll be a lot of fun out at the Ice Cube.
Well, best of luck to you and to the coaches and the assistant coaches and everybody on the staffs and, of course, to the student-athletes who've come back or coming to for the first time to Purdue University Northwest for another year of not only academics but athletics as well. Thanks for joining us to talk about it today.
Thanks for having me on the program. And as I always like to end, go Pride!
Rick Costello is the athletic director for Purdue University Northwest, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. Kevin Comerford of the Construction Advancement Foundation talks about the newest building at Purdue University Northwest Hammond Campus on this week's Building Northwest Indiana.
Well, welcome to another episode of Building Northwest Indiana. My name is Kevin Comerford. I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation of Northwest Indiana, and I'll be serving as your host today. The purpose of Building Northwest Indiana Radio is to give you a little insight on the Northwest Indiana professional construction industry. Today, I'll be talking about the new Bioscience Innovation Building at Purdue University Northwest that is currently under construction at the Hammond, Indiana campus. My guest today is Jacob Lenson. Jacob is the Assistant Vice Chancellor of Campus Planning at Purdue University Northwest. Jacob, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to talk about this project.
I recently had the opportunity to take a tour of the Bioscience Innovation Building over at your Hammond campus, and I have to say I'm pretty impressed with the scale of the project. A lot of our listeners are familiar with Purdue University, but probably not so familiar with the Bioscience Innovation Building. Can you tell us a little bit about that building? What is your role on the project? What is the purpose of the building, and how will it serve the needs of your students?
Yes, I'm very involved in the project. First and foremost, the project was recently named by Purdue University. It will now be known as Nils K. Nelson Bioscience Innovation Building. Nils Nelson was a professor at Purdue Calumet, who recently passed away and donated over $8 million to Purdue. Part of that will go to student scholarships, and part of that will go to the naming of the building. And with that in mind, this building that you're speaking of, it's the first academic new building at the Hammond campus in over 20 years. It's 68,000 square feet. It will serve the School of Biology and the College of Nursing. That's important to note that currently we have existing laboratories on the Hammond campus that are, from the original 1950s building. This project is a little bit different than the architecture and construction at the Hammond campus, based on new technology, different type of buildings, a lot more glass, transparency. And my role on the project is to serve as the owner's representative for Purdue Northwest. I'm an architect and interior designer by trade, so my role is coordination between the architect of record, construction manager, and the prospective tenants.
So you had mentioned construction manager, and I am under the impression that this might be the first project built in Northwest Indiana under a newer project delivery system. I think back in 2014, the state legislature passed a new law that allowed for a construction manager as constructor method of project delivery to build public facilities. And like I said, to my knowledge, I think this is the first building in Northwest Indiana to use this method. Can you explain exactly what a construction manager as constructor method of project delivery is, and what are some of the benefits that the university has gained from using this project delivery method?
Yes, to my knowledge, you're correct. I believe this is the first state-funded project in higher education, at least in Northwest Indiana, that has used this method. It's also known as construction manager at risk. The short answer to the benefits that Purdue will receive is budget and schedule. To expand upon that, in the design, bid, build, delivery method, the contractor isn't involved until after bid. We have the luxury with the CMC format of bringing in a contractor through the design. So the benefit of doing so is we're able to deliver the project on budget, a guaranteed budget, and we shave approximately 6 months off the schedule. So for Purdue, to have a guaranteed project is ideal. In the old method of design, bid, build, there's always a chance that we can come in over the budget that was set by the state, in which the project would either be significantly delayed or even canceled. So those are the main benefits for us to get a contractor involved early and use this method.
So the contract that you have involved early is actually considered the construction manager?
Correct.
And who is the construction manager on this particular project?
It's a joint venture between Berglund Construction and Power & Sons.
Okay. What are their roles under this particular project delivery system?
So again, there's basically two parts of their contract. The main and most important thing to me and Purdue is the pre-design services. So throughout the design, they partner with the architect, which is Canon Design out of Chicago, to go through each stage of design from the schematic and design development level to do constructability reviews and scope development as well as budget development. And then after we get to the stage of construction documentation, then they serve as a typical construction manager with general oversight, supplying contracts to all the subcontractors, which in turn they're responsible for the schedule and budget.
Yeah, it sounds like by having the CM involved early in the project, you probably avoid a lot of different conflicts that are associated with your typical design, bid, build.
And we do, and we're allowed, basically with this method, you're able to go out and get pricing without 100% CD. So again, it expedites the schedule. And with this method too, and this magnitude of building, just to give you an idea, Berglund has two full-time employees, one superintendent, one project manager out there full-time, 40 hours a week. And Power & Sons also has a full-time employee, 40 hours a week, serving as project engineer.
I guess the big question is, when will this project be completed? And I guess to go along with that, what is the total cost of the project?
So the total cost of the project is $40,500,000. That project entails a few things. So that includes the new construction. It also includes the demolition of one of the early buildings at the Hammond campus, the Guite Annex. The substantial completion for new construction is actually April 17th of 2020. We're currently about 50% complete, and we're on schedule and on budget. And then the Guite Annex demolition will be demolished in the summer of 2020. We don't plan to occupy and start utilizing the space until the fall semester of 2020 in August.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. Thanks again to our guest, Jacob Lenson, Assistant Vice Chancellor of Campus Planning at Purdue University Northwest. I'm your host, Kevin Comerford. Thanks for joining us today.
And Kevin was talking with Jacob Lenson, who is the Assistant Vice Chancellor of Campus Planning at Purdue University Northwest. Support for Building Northwest Indiana is brought to you by the Construction Advancement Foundation. And you can hear Building Northwest Indiana right here on Tuesdays, here on Lakeshore Public Radio on Regionally Speaking. And the podcasts are also available online right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. When you pump gas, it comes out of large tanks that are beneath the station. They often leak, sending gasoline into the ground and sometimes into the drinking water. Indiana reimburses companies that clean up these leaks up to $2.5 million per site. That's more than any other state in the country. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, the state says some companies are taking advantage of the fund, and that could mean the fund is in danger of running out of money.
Greg Cobb and his family own 6 gas stations and convenience stores in the Warsaw area. Last year, he received a copy of a bill showing how much a company he hired was getting reimbursed to clean up contamination at one of those stations. It was for $650,000. And Cobb says the work wasn't even done.
I was pretty shocked. I was shocked when I saw how much they had already spent and hadn't really gotten anywhere.
Cobb says he fired the company and hired a new one, though the work still isn't finished. The problem is, it's mostly your money they're spending. For every gallon of gas that goes into your car, you pay a penny into a fund for cleanups. And if there's not enough money for cleanups, these gas tank leaks could put Hoosiers' drinking water at risk. Last fiscal year, there were more than 170 leaks across the state. 2 years ago, the average cost for cleaning up a tank leak in Indiana was more than three times the national average. So, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management turned to legislators for help. It crafted a bill that clarified who can get reimbursed through the fund and how many hours they can get paid for certain tasks. At a state Senate hearing, IDEM's chief of staff, Brian Rockensoos, said, because of abuse and declining revenues, there's only about $75 million left in the fund.
If we drop to $25 million, the fund will go into priority payment. And what this means is we will only pay for claims on sites that pose an imminent threat to human health and the environment.
But the bill never made it past committee. While IDEM is pointing the finger at companies doing cleanups, some companies are pointing it right back at IDEM. Between 2013 and 2017, Golar's Environmental Engineering was reimbursed for more money than any other company in the state. Former Indiana Attorney General Greg Zeller serves as general counsel for Golar's. He says it's not that the company is charging too much, it's that IDEM is taking too long to approve cleanup plans.
You have to keep waiting for IDEM to approve the last thing before you move on to the next part of the plan. If it takes a year, that's going to be four quarterly monitors, which can cost anywhere between $5,000 and $10,000.
But more importantly, Zeller says,
there's nothing that goes on that is not required by the agency.
Maybe IDEM and remediation companies are both to blame for draining the fund. That's what Sue Esserman thinks. She's a former IDEM employee, currently in a lawsuit with the agency. Esserman used to review claims until she was fired in 2014. IDEM says it was for poor performance, but she says it was because she refused to rubber stamp costly claims.
I'm kind of a stickler for details, have been for many years, and if you're going to be reimbursed for labor hours, contractor costs, supply costs, I would like to see the documentation.
Esserman says there was a lot of pressure to review and approve claims quickly. She says because no one was looking too carefully, companies doing cleanups were more likely to abuse the system.
Good morning again.
Good morning.
When Greg Cobb started working in the gasoline business more than three decades ago, he says the industry was a lot less careful. Gas tanks didn't have double walls. There were no catch basins for leaks under the pump.
It wasn't uncommon for a transport driver to overfill a tank and have it running down the street.
Many of those old tanks, and the contamination that came with them, are still there today, threatening the health of Hoosiers and the environment. If the money in the fund goes away, it's unclear if there will be an incentive to clean them up. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
And Rebecca tells us that IDEM is working to change some of the ways that the Excess Liability Trust Fund operates. But she says that she's learned the process takes at least 16 to 18 months. We've seen changes in the number of youngsters being held in juvenile detention here in Lake County over the last almost 10 years. And Lake County is shifting its focus to help better prepare young people who are on probation for adulthood. Let's find out more about a very ambitious program that Lake County Juvenile Court Judge Thomas Stefaniak is initiating. Kevin Elkins, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
I'm the Lake County JDAI coordinator. Uh-huh. I just started in this actual position in December, and that's the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative. That's a nationwide initiative sponsored through Annie Casey to decrease detention admissions throughout the country for juveniles.
What was it like when you first started working for the Lake County juvenile system? What were your job duties at the time? And you've mentioned what you've kind of evolved into now with the initiative through the Annie Casey Foundation. But what were things like when you first came to Lake County back in the 90s?
Yeah, when I first started here, it was, I believe, like 1994. I was a detention officer, which that role was just to basically care for the kids in the back, make sure that they were cared for properly, make sure that they followed the schedule, make sure there were no fights, make sure they got all the basic needs they needed, and interact with the kids. We used to have, I mean, on a daily basis, we would have 100 kids in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the old detention section where we had four wings. We even had it to one point where we would have to house kids in our day room to sleep at night, called day room sleepers, because we didn't have enough rooms for them. So it's definitely been a decrease from in the 90s.
What were some of the things that Judge Stefaniak has done since he's taken over in the Lake County Juvenile Court system to help make it easier for not only for you folks in the centers and just the general population as far as the probation department is concerned, to be able to get youngsters out of that mode that they're in, like kind of being almost in lockup, but in being able to become full-fledged citizens, be adults, to have jobs and the like?
Well, a few things we've done. We've changed some of our policies on the youth that we've detained. We've changed, we've gone to using a lot more of the electronic home monitoring system. We're also trying to develop a program where we work with the kids and focus them on job opportunities and job possibilities. So we've set up an account with Indiana Cooter, which is a job assessment skill tool that a lot of the schools are using now already in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically a job skills assessment tool to let them know what they're good at and what they might want to pursue for a job career. We're having our probation officers work with our youth that are on probation to do this and go through it with them and maybe just talk about them about what the possibilities are for them.
I know that Lake County is a very integral part of the Indiana Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. It's a relatively new initiative, I understand, and at least for Lake County recently. What seems to be the goal within the initiative, and how well are things kind of following through on the plans that you all have worked on to be part of the initiative?
Well, it's not a brand new initiative. There is it started in about 2010 with our county.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus to this point has been a lot on detention admissions, and we've done a very good job of that. Back in 2010, we had admissions to the juvenile center. We had 1,916 in 2010, down to 611 in 2018.
Wow.
So the average daily population for our center in 2010 was 69 kids per day. And it decreased down to 28 in 2018. So we've definitely had a decrease, and we've done a good job with the detention aspect of it. Now we're trying to switch our focus into transforming what we do with our probation department. And that's where we're going to look into trying to focus some of our attention with them on job skills and push them towards the area of at least thinking about what they want to do with their future a little bit more than we have in the past.
I understand that's quite a change now than what it has been in the past for those probation officers that have had contact with young people. What were some of the things in the past that seemed to be the emphasis, and now it's changed over now?
Well, we've always had contact in the field with kids on probation. We've mm-hmm. always tried to tell them to do the right thing. It's just that now we're kind of trying to look into some of the things like a Cooter assessment to maybe focus a little bit more on job skills. We're actually trying to reach out to some of the trades, any businesses that would be interested in forming a relationship with our juvenile court to do something as minor as just having a youth shadow somebody at their job place or coming out to talk to a group of youth to let them know what's possible at their job place. We'd like for the trade to allow us maybe to come in and do a day with the kids at the trade to see what goes on at the unions and the trade shops in the area here. Because really, we found out in this research that the trades are really looking for people, and those are very well-paying jobs. Like, I wish I would have knew some of the information we found out about how much they pay and how to get into trades when I was coming through school. It might have been an option for me instead of getting all this school debt that I had to go through. And I know that's a big topic right now for the country,
yeah.
School debt. So one of the ways maybe some of our kids could avoid some of that school debt is by going to work through the trades for a little while, and then you could pay for your own school if you like to, or you might want to just continue in the trades because it's a great job.
I know that, you and Judge Stefaniak have talked about this, about the fact that that you have the idea that jobs are very important because it's really part of a life plan that, a young person has to get accustomed to. It's part of changing from being a young person to being adult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we just like to push that focus on them and let them know what's possible. Because a lot of times, we always say this, what you don't know, you don't know. It's like I didn't know as a kid that you could go and be an electrician or a plumber, or there was a union to do the sprinkler system in buildings. I wasn't aware of all that. I wasn't aware of how much they paid. So we just like to at least expose our youth to some of these options for them.
Are some of the ideas that, you've brought up here in our conversation today that, are basically system-wide within the Lake County Probation Department system, are these ideas that have been tried and true in some other locations? Are some of these ideas maybe you've come up that are, specifically for Lake County?
Well, it would be specific to Lake County. We do have some residential facilities that we've placed kids into in the past that have taught trades, and we really like that aspect. We've had some kids come back from some of the facilities where they were certified in to be an electrician or in carpentry. We even had one facility that was training kids how to be an opticianry,
yeah,
where they could make eyeglasses from scratch, and they could go into an eye emporium and get a job. So I'm not sure if we'll get to that point where we'll be able to do a training program like that, but that's our goal, is to at least expose our youth to what's possible.
I understand that, the department has sought a $54,000 grant to be able to expand on in the 2019 and 2020 funding year that can go towards these job readiness programs.
Yeah, well, the grant will actually cover some of the programming that we're going to do as far as like art programming, some music programming. A piece of it will be some job readiness programming. Work One will be working with us. An organization called J&J Ministries, the contracts will work on to do a job ethic program. They'll be working with us a little bit. We'll also have a tattoo removal program through Bugaboo Tattoo. They're going to come in and do some removal for some of our youth that would like to remove some of the, you know, young, youthful mistakes that they make with tattoos. We'd like to get them opportunity to remove some of those. And then we'll also have a like a socialization program through PAD, a Positive Approach to Teen Health. It's a relationship positive relationship program to teach kids how to have positive relationships, basically. And they'll be coming in to work with some of our kids as well.
Now, since you've had the chance to work with a many number of young people, not only over the years, but in recent years here, since a lot of these initiatives have been started by Judge Stefaniak, what kind of reaction have you gotten, not only from the young people, but also from family members and others who are close to them, as to how it seems to be changing these young people's lives?
Yeah, everybody seems to love the idea, especially of the job part of it. Everybody definitely thinks that's a good idea to keep our youth as busy as possible. And give them ideas, positive ideas, because when you leave them idle, they seem to come up with their own ideas just like we did when we were youth. So we'd like to push them towards a more positive path, and we've got positive feedback from parents, from the community, and from some of the organizations that we've talked to that are willing to work with us and come in and talk with some of our kids.
Yeah.
So we definitely like to put it out there that we're open to any organization that would like to come in and work with us and see what we can partner on. So they can feel free to contact me on my cell phone. It's area code 219-902-4355.
Now, I know that the Judge Stefaniak's a very busy fellow, and you oftentimes probably have a chance maybe in between cases to talk with him about some of these things. What are some ideas that maybe you have offered to him that will maybe turn into some things in within the entire program in the future?
Well, the CUDA job career assessment was one of the things I thought of. One other area I like to see, I've heard of a job like training program that Indiana Plan does, where they do like a 2-week, I don't know, boot camp with adults to show them the trades and let them know what you need to do to get into the trades. So we're hoping that we can do something similar with our juveniles and sort of like a boot camp so they can understand and go see what some of the trades do and actually go put hands on and see what they do.
I know you mentioned that in particular. In fact, we know just lately here the Indiana Plan got together with some of the construction trades here in Lake County in Northwest Indiana to offer up an opportunity to learn more about the jobs that are available for those folks out there. So that might fit in well with what you mentioned about trying to get the union trades involved in more things to help the young people involved in the probation department.
They did a hands-on type fair at the Geary Career Center.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to develop one where we could focus it on our probation youth, and maybe we can do it either here at the Juvenile Center or at another location, but that's something that we're trying to work on right now.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much for spending time to talk about the program that's now exist, what your thoughts and hopes are for the future as you get more young people who are involved in the juvenile probation system able to go into the outside world, into real jobs, and learn something and become very, very productive in their own lives as well as in the lives of the community as well. Thank you for spending time with us today.
No problem. I appreciate it.
Kevin Elkins is the chief supervisor for the Lake County Juvenile Probation Department, and he's been telling us about a very interesting program, or series of programs, actually, that have been put into place ever since Lake County Juvenile Court Judge Thomas Stefaniak has come into office. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow on the program, we'll have conversations, including those with State Representative Carolyn B. Jackson of Hammond, with Jenny Beleza with the Indiana Parenting Institute, and Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. We hope you can join us.